So, good evening, everybody. Lovely to see you here. My name's Sudarshini, and this week I'm going to be exploring with you the topic of free will, which I think is actually the most important and the most interesting philosophical topic, and it directly affects, I think, the way we approach our life, and it's one that has puzzled me for many years and interested me, and I still don't fully understand it. I don't think it's possible to grasp it completely conceptually, and that's where the magic is, actually. So what I'm hoping to do tonight is to unpack it a little bit as a philosophical concept, because it's quite a... Well, it's like 2 weeks ago I had the same problem. It's quite difficult to do something like this in the time available without being highly selective and a little superficial. So apologies in advance if I oversimplify things or I don't talk about your favourite philosopher. That's bound to happen. Okay. So I want to say a little bit about free will, and in particular that this dichotomy that is often set up between free will and determinism. In philosophy, it's often put across that we either believe in free will or we are determinists. And what I'm hoping to show to some extent tonight is that that is a bit of a false dichotomy, and that Buddhism allows us a way in. We could say that Buddhism, the Buddha's teaching on conditionality, is the middle way between free will and determinism. So let's see how we get on. So I'm going to start with determinism. Many philosophers have, I think, and I think many people, have a kind of unthinking acceptance of free will in our society, because what they see as the alternative, determinism, is so deeply unattractive. So I found a short and quite neat little definition of determinism, which is that determinism is the doctrine which asserts that everything which happens in the universe, including the actions and decisions of human beings, is in principle predictable. So it's this element of predictability that makes something determined. So you probably all think that you came here tonight of your own free will. I assume that nobody dragged you here kicking and screaming. So I imagine that most of you, at any rate, are here because you think, at any rate, that you freely decided to. Now, a determinist would say that is not the case. The fact that you're here tonight was always going to be the case. You actually had no choice in the matter. You think you had a choice, you felt like you had a choice, but anybody who knew, and this is quite interesting where it says it's in principle predictable, everybody who knew all the different things that led to you coming here tonight, if you knew all those factors, then they would have been able to predict that you would have been here tonight, and you had absolutely no choice in the matter. Okay, so that's determinism. For most people, even if they kind of flirt with that idea or they can't see any way out of that idea, most people don't actually believe it. Yeah, they don't actually believe it. And they don't actually believe it for quite good reasons, but I'll come to those in a moment. Just want to say, well, where does this idea of determinism come from? Why would anybody believe that? That everything that ever happens is in principle predictable. That in principle is a funny little term, actually, because we know that things aren't predictable, you know, in a normal sort of way. I mean, if they were, life would be much more straightforward, wouldn't it? I mean, if you know, fortune tellers would, well, they'd be out of a job because we'd all know, we'd all be able to predict exactly what's going to happen to us. So it is only that it's in principle predictable. Well, determinism seems to have come from two sources. It runs actually through a certain strand of Christianity. And it seems to have come into Western philosophy at the time of this is probably not true. It probably came into Western philosophy long before that. But I kind of associate it with Newtonian physics and with the discovery that everything runs in accordance with the laws of nature. Quite interesting. I thought maybe I didn't really have time to go into the Christian background, but I think it's quite interesting and quite important. Most Christians believe in free will, and for the most part, free will is a very important Christian concept. In fact, I think it's a concept that's been imported from Christianity and doesn't necessarily stand up philosophically. But it's interesting that there is a very definite strand of determinism in Christianity, which started with St. Augustine, who is the kind of father of Christianity, much to its detriment, I think. His thinking has certainly permeated Christian thought. He seemed to hold simultaneously two completely opposing views. Sometimes he talks about free will, but what he also says is that everything has been predestined by God. There's a certain way in which, if you believe in God as the omnipotent, omniscient creator of the universe, in a way, you might have to say that everything is predestined, because if we have free will, then we are no longer under the control of the Almighty. If God creates a world and then allows us to do what we want, he's no longer in control. And certainly there's been quite a strong strain of Christian thinking which has said that, no, we don't have free will. The doctrine of predestination is quite an extraordinary one, as in the teachings of John Calvin in the 16th century, I think, where he developed this whole theology that everything is one act of the will of God. The universe is an act of the will of God. And that human beings fall into two camps. There is the elect, who will go to heaven, and there is the damned. And there's actually nothing we can do about it. If you're one of the elect, no matter what you do, you go to heaven. If you're one of the damned, again, no matter what you do, you go to hell. I think if you are a Calvinist, I'm probably, you know, if we had a Calvinist here, they'd probably take issue with me. But yeah, I kind of think that a Calvinist themselves would argue that, well, Calvinists are all part of the elect. If you believe in that, God wouldn't have created you in such a way as to believe that unless you were one of the elect. So I think they can all tell themselves that they are going to heaven. How they quite then get on with the idea of a God who will condemn great swathes of mankind to everlasting torment through no fault of their own, I don't know. I've never really got to grips with that. Anyway, so that's Christian determinism in the form of predestination. As I said, determinism on the philosophical side tends to come from this idea that everything runs in accordance with the laws of nature, so that everything in the physical world has to behave according to those laws. So if I haven't got a pen, if I throw something up into the air, it will go up into the air. As long as the force takes it up there, then gravity takes over and pushes it back down. I'm no physicist, but that's broadly speaking how I understand it. And I can't do anything about that unless some other force comes in to interfere. So if we are entirely physical beings, if we are matter and nothing else but matter, then we have to operate in accordance with the laws of nature. And this kind of puts philosophers in a bit of a difficult situation, because especially those that are on the kind of scientific materialist side, they don't really want to admit that there is something within human beings, say, which doesn't operate according to strict laws, something which is not non-physical. Many of them don't want to admit that. So it then becomes a bit tricky as to how you go with that. Some have tried to show that determinism is compatible with freedom. Some have tried to dismiss it as a non-problem, but I think the problem does still remain. And determinism is a very, very difficult doctrine to seriously hold. You can't prove that it's not true, but if you are serious about being a determinist, there are certain things you have to take on board. And Brian McGee talks about one of these, and I'll just quote what he says. He says, determinism seems to be one of those doctrines, if you like, that can't be proved, logically proved not to be true. But he says it's refutable by one of those arguments which, though not logically hermetic, is in practice irresistible. He says, if determinism is true, every last feature of both the natural and the man-made worlds must have been materially and irreversibly specified in the protozoic slime. More than that, if the Big Bang theory is correct, in the very opening fractions of a second of that cosmic explosion, all the necessary and sufficient conditions were present for everything that has ever existed or happened since. The exact specifications and movements of every physical object that has ever existed, including every flick of every wrist and every flicker of every eyebrow, plus the precise character of every abstract entity that has ever been evolved within the world, every idea, every symphony, even, say, every television programme, not to mention every word that every person has ever uttered. Logically, of course, it is possible that this was so, but I do not see how anyone could believe it. Okay, well, I'll leave you to make of that as you will, whether you think it's still possible for everything to have been determined like that. But there is another aspect, of course, which is much more tricky, which is that if everything is determined, then there is no way any of us has any moral responsibility for anything that we do. This is a problem with Calvinism, and it's a problem for any of us that want to take a determinist view of life, that we don't have any moral responsibility ourselves, and nobody else has any moral responsibility either. Concepts such as good and evil, right and wrong, ideas about people doing their duty, praise, blame, admiring someone, not admiring them, all these things are completely empty. They have no content at all, because actually nobody is actually deciding to do anything. We're just being programmed. Okay. Kant decided that it was actually impossible, humanly impossible, to hold that view. And he was in a bit of a conundrum with this, because if you remember from 2 weeks ago, it was Kant that Kant did all sorts of things. The one thing he did was distinguish between the phenomenal and the noumenal. Do you remember that, those of you who were here? So he believed that, as far as that the phenomenal world is the world of our sense experience. Remember that for Kant, what we actually experience through our senses is then mediated through the particular apparatus of our minds. So if you remember, we actually contribute to how our world appears to us. We can only experience the world through space, time and causality. This was Kant's great insight into the nature of reality. It's not a given, it is an interaction between whatever is there and what we do to create it. And the world of sense experience is the world of phenomena. But he also believed that underlying the world of sense experience, the world of phenomena, was the noumena. The noumena is what's really there, and phenomena is what we experience. So Kant's approach to free will was quite a clever one, really, because he's a very rigorous philosopher, Kant. I really admire him for that. He's very, very rigorous. He was also a devout Christian, and not of the Calvinist kind. He believed that God would give us free will. He believed that we are moral agents. He believed we are responsible for our actions. So he couldn't take the determinist position. So his solution was to say that, well, on the phenomenal level, on the level of phenomena, everything is determined, but on the noumenal level, we are free. And he really distinguished three types of freedom. The freedom on the phenomenal level is freedom like physical freedom. So if anybody had tried to stop you coming tonight, you wouldn't have been able to come because you would have been physically restrained. There is also there is mental freedom, having the mental wherewithal to be able to do things, so that if you have certain impairments of the brain, there are certain things that you can't do. But he believed that as moral agents, we are acting from the noumena. He believed it was the noumenal within us that was giving rise to our acts of will, and that our acts of will are therefore free because they come from the noumenal. So now I've moved over into a way of being able to combine determinism with free will. Okay, so free will, the idea that our choices are free. What choices we make issue in action. And once that action takes place, then physical laws obviously take over. But the actual choice that we make is free. That is the idea behind free will. And this is what the way Kant solved it was to say that acts of choice, come from the noumenal, which give rise to acts in the world. I want to go on to Schopenhauer now, going back to determinism. But before I do this, and I meant to do this before I talked about Kant, the way I want to go is I want to go to Schopenhauer and then I want to come into Buddhism. But I want to say something about a philosopher who is on the end of the spectrum, which completely embraces free will. So as I've said, Kant had a kind of modified version of free will. He felt that inasmuch as our choices come from the noumenal, they are free. But he also believes that a lot of our choices don't come from the noumenal, and therefore they're not free. But I'll come back to that in a moment. The person I want to talk about now is a 20th century French philosopher called Jean-Paul Sartre, which some of you may know something about. I have to say that my knowledge of Sartre is from memory of undergraduate studies about 30-odd years ago. Okay, I haven't actually gone back to Sartre to research him since. So if there's any Sartrean experts among you, I'm probably not doing him complete justice. But I do have very fond memories of my study of Sartre. It was the part of my philosophy studies that I enjoyed the most, doing Sartre and existentialism. I suppose because existentialism is interesting because it's the philosophy which looks at our subjective experience, our experience as human beings, rather than the nature of reality or whatever. It's very much how we experience the world. And as far as I remember, Sartre had quite a radical view about freedom. I don't quite know how he got to that view, but as I understand it, Sartre believed that we are completely free. Now, I might have to just look at this a little bit, because if I'm being a good philosopher, I should be defining my terms a little bit, and freedom is a funny sort of concept altogether. Because to say we're absolutely free, in a way, doesn't make any sense. We can't be absolutely free. We're not free to fly, for instance. Well, we can go in an aeroplane, but we can't actually jump off a building and fly down to the ground. There are all sorts of limitations. An 81-year-old person is not going to be able to win an Olympic medal, or probably not. You know, I think we all have limitations on our freedom. We can't just say we are completely free to do anything we want to do. There are going to be limitations. As far as I can see, Sartre acknowledged that. But what I think is interesting about Sartre is that he said that, well, okay, there are external limitations, but we are free to respond to those limitations in whatever way we want to. We choose how we respond to whatever our life circumstances are. And he says that it's this freedom that gives rise to existential anxiety. This term angst, which you might have heard of, which I find is a really interesting term. I think it bears some resemblance to what the Buddha was talking about with dukkha. It's peculiar to the human condition, because it's only human beings, says Sartre, that have this existential angst. And it comes from the fact that we are deeply and radically free. And in this way, we are completely unlike objects, physical objects. So, for instance, this bowl is a physical object, and it is what it is. It's completely what it is. It is what it is, and it's not another thing. Human beings are never able to do that. Human beings are never able to be completely what they are. They are what he called them. He says we are a human being is a being for itself. An object is a being in itself. And because we are terrified of our own freedom, we actually try to deny that freedom and become a being in itself. Because freedom means that we can never feel secure. We try very hard to feel secure, so we do things like we get married. But the problem is, we always know that our partner can, however much they might vow to love us till death us do part, our partner can change their minds. Not only that, we can change our minds. It's always possible that we are going to not carry out what we have decided to do. This is the story of every New Year's Eve, isn't it? You vow to give up smoking, and a few days later, you know in that very act that you are still free to go and buy a packet of cigarettes in a week's time. And it's this sort of thing, this kind of thing that we can never actually really guarantee that we're going to be a particular kind of person or do a particular thing, which gives rise to this existential anxiety. So he says the strategy we use is to deny that we have choice. And the example I always remember is the one that where he says that it's like when the alarm clock goes off in the morning. The alarm clock goes off in the morning and we tell ourselves we have to get up. We do that, don't we? We have to get up. We have to go to work. When we do that, says Sartre, he says that we are acting in bad faith. Or was it bad faith? Mauvais foi, I think it is. Because actually, we don't have to get up, we don't have to go to work, we are choosing to do so. And actually, sometimes we don't, do we? We turn over and go back to sleep again. But a lot of the time, we tell ourselves that we have to do things when actually we are choosing to do them. And I just love that idea. I still love that idea, and I remind myself of it quite often. I catch myself out in saying, well, I've got to do something, when actually I know that I'm just choosing to do it. And we often, I remember a talk Dharma Dinner gave here about keeping the creative initiative, and it was about this very thing, really, that we can think that choices we've made in our life are now limiting us, but the fact is we have chosen them. So we might think that we can't do X, Y, and Z because of our job, because of our partner, because of this and that. But actually, we're choosing to continue to be constrained by that situation. We could choose to get out of that situation. But what we're really saying is we prefer that situation to what the alternative is. So we're choosing to stay in it. And Sartre says that to live authentically means facing up to the fact that we are free and that we have choices. And even though we do have limitations, we can respond to those limitations in whatever way we choose. I seem to remember he used the example of Roosevelt, who had polio and managed to become President of America. And people said the same about Obama being black and still managing to become President of America. So it's overcoming perceived limitations, because they are not really limitations at all. So that's what I remember of Sartre's philosophy: complete radical freedom. Okay, so let's make sure I know what I'm doing here. Okay, what I want to do now... I just want to say something else about free will before I go on to Schopenhauer. And that is for completeness, to say something about the Christian approach to free will. I've said that there is a strain in Christianity which is determinist. But by and large, the concept of free will is, I think, a Christian concept. And in a way, although there is a problem with free will, because once we have free will, we're out of God's control, it is also a really important concept for Christians because we have to be seen as moral agents. The whole of Christian theology is structured on reward and punishment and judgment. So we have to be free to act morally, by our own choice. And as I see it, the idea of free will comes from the fact that there is a real problem in why God, who created a perfect world, why that world went wrong. And free will seems to be the best explanation for that. It wasn't God that made the world go wrong, it was us. So by having free will, we chose to disobey God. Adam and Eve, that's what the story is, isn't it? Adam and Eve. God created Adam and Eve, the Garden of Eden. Everything was perfect until Eve decided to disobey God, take the fruit from the tree and offer it to Adam. And that is how sin and suffering came into the world. So I think it's a really deeply entrenched idea from Christianity, which is... one reason, I think, that we accept free will as unthinkingly as we do, actually. So I want to now move on to, see, Sartre with his radical freedom. I now want to move to Schopenhauer, who, as Manjusia said at the beginning of the class, is a bit of a determinist. Although his philosophy actually has quite a lot in common with Kant, because if you remember from 2 weeks ago, Schopenhauer completely followed Kant in the idea of that we create our worlds, well, we create our worlds in the sense that the phenomenal world comes through the particular structure of our minds and our senses. Now, Schopenhauer had a slightly different take on the noumenal, and his different take on the noumenal did not allow him to come to the kind of solution that Kant came to. So Kant was able to say, in the world of phenomena, we might be restrained physically, we have to follow physical laws, but morally we are free, because morally our actions spring from the noumenal. Schopenhauer said, well, that can't be the case. It can't be the case because the noumenal can't actually give rise to anything. The noumenal can't cause anything to happen. Causality, by Kant's own philosophy, can only apply to the phenomenal, to the world of phenomena. It can't apply to the noumenal. So we can't say that acts of will arise from the noumenal. And Schopenhauer is fairly thoroughgoing in his in his dismissal of any attempt to say that in any normal sense of the word we are free. He says that just as events in the outside world follow physical laws of nature, so if we look within, everything that we do springs from motives and character. So, as Manjusia said, according to Schopenhauer, we have a particular character. We are born with it. We are born with a particular character, and there's nothing we can do about that. That is how we are. We have a particular set of tendencies, a particular way in which we respond to the world, a particular set of inherited characteristics which make up our character. So he says, when we're faced with a decision as to what to do, so let's say all of you, perhaps some of you did, maybe some of you did really ponder whether you should come tonight to this class. Some of you may have just come anyway, but some of you may have thought, should I really go to the class tonight? Now, according to Schopenhauer, what was going on there was that different motives were fighting for ascendancy over your will, and the decision you made in the end depended on your particular character. Okay, so if you're the sort of person who tends to decide that you're going to do something that is, say, good for the mind, that is going to actually be something that benefits you in a particular spiritual way, the chances are that motive to come here would win out against other motives, which might be, it's a cold night, I want to stay indoors, there's a good program on television, or all the other hundreds of things which you might have chosen to do rather than come here. You thought you were freely choosing to come here. Actually, all that was happening was that there was this tussle between different motives as to which was going to win out. And he says that there is no way any of us act freely. We kid ourselves if we think we're acting freely. We are acting in accordance with our character and as a result of particular motives. Motives, he says, are causes in the same, they're internal causes. Just like in outside world, one thing causes another, motives are simply causes for our actions. Where they come from, well, I suppose I suppose there could be things that we consider, as to how they're going to whether they're going to prompt us to action. But which motives we actually decide to take notice of depends on our character. Because, you know, everybody can think, oh, well, I could do this and I could do this and this would be good and that would be good. But the ones that we actually take notice of depend on our character. I think it's quite an interesting view, because actually it's not quite the end of the story. Schopenhauer, I think, realises that for all the reasons I said earlier, it's actually impossible to hold that view. Kant argued that it was actually literally impossible to hold that view. That's why he didn't hold it. He said, you cannot hold that view. As a human being, you cannot hold a determinist view. Schopenhauer wanted to hold a determinist view, but, you know, as McGee points out, Schopenhauer is a right hypocrite when it comes to that, because he is forever... He's very entertaining to read, Schopenhauer, because he is so dismissive of other philosophers. He's such a misogynist. He has no patience with other human beings, generally, particularly women. And he always writes as if other people really are stupid, and not just stupid, but they are, well, not all other people, but that they behave in ways that are reprehensible. So he's condemning people. And of course he's being totally illogical, because nobody can help being the way they are, on Schopenhauer's view. Schopenhauer considered himself to be a genius. Well, it was no credit to him, was it? Obviously, it was just from his inherited genetics and his character, which happened to lead to a certain way in which he did philosophy. No credit to him. It was just automatic. It was always going to happen. And I think... look at the time. I've got to move on from here. I think Schopenhauer himself saw that. And, of course, Schopenhauer had the sense of the noumenon. So, very, very quickly, I want to say that if you remember from 2 weeks ago, Schopenhauer's take on the noumenal was not that there was that every phenomenon has a noumenon, but that the whole of the phenomenal world has a noumenal aspect to it. But what he believed about the noumenal was that it was undifferentiated, it was one. And it's almost, when he talks about it, it's almost like he goes into some kind of mystical sense of saying that we all partake of the noumenal. So we're kind of born into the phenomenal, the world of phenomena, but we are all expressions of the noumenal. And one of the things that I really like about Schopenhauer's philosophy is that he sees that because of that, because we all are expressions of the noumenal, the one, we have this capacity for compassion and empathy. And that we wouldn't have that capacity for compassion and empathy if it were not for the noumenal. And here he sees where there may be a possibility of freedom, that welling up of compassion into us. But of course he can't say that it causes it. So he's in a bit of a cleft stick, I think, Schopenhauer. I might be doing him a slight injustice, but I find it difficult to understand quite what he means by with his view of the possibility of freedom. Okay, now then. Okay. I want to move on now to Buddhism. And I think there's quite a lot in the ideas that I've talked about, both of the noumenal, of the possibility of freedom, of us being moral agents, but also the possibility that we are largely determined, but maybe completely free, which for me helped me to understand the Buddhist position. Because in a way, we could say that Buddhism holds contradictory views on this. And for a long time, while I was sort of in the ordination process, This was something that puzzled me a lot. Because on the one hand, the Buddha talks of the Dharma as having the taste of freedom. That's what he says characterizes the Dharma, the taste of freedom. Enlightenment, one of the defining characteristics of enlightenment is freedom. Liberation. The Buddha talks about liberation as a characteristic of enlightenment. At the same time, he says that everything is conditioned. Everything is conditioned. Everything arises in dependence upon conditions. And when those conditions cease, so whatever that arises ceases as well. And for quite a while I thought, well, this means that if everything is conditioned, where does the freedom come in? How can we be free to follow a Buddhist path if everything is conditioned? And people would say to me, oh, but you set up the right conditions in order to follow a Buddhist path. And I'd say, but what makes you set up the right conditions? Isn't that conditioned as well? And certainly the way the Buddha talks, he talks, for instance, that a human being consists of nothing other than the five skandhas. If you've recited, sat here and recited the Heart Sutra, the skandhas are described as form, feeling, thought, choice, and consciousness. Choice is one of the skandhas. Volitions is one of the skandhas. It's part of the conditioned world. So this was a puzzle to me for a long time. So I thought, well, you know, where's the freedom? How can we be free to act? So just want to say a little bit about this, which is that conditionality is not the same thing as causality. Determinism believes that things cause things which cause things, and that everything is predictable. Remember that? That everything in principle is predictable. Conditionality, well, causality then implies that everything is discrete things that produce an effect on other things. So the billiard ball example, a billiard ball rolls along the table, hits another billiard ball, causing it to move. That was Hume's example. And Hume said, well, actually, we can't prove any causal connection there. But if we look at conditionality, we'll see that actually what led to that billiard ball moving was so many things. Wasn't just one cause, wasn't even just several causes. It's actually an infinite number of causal factors. And they don't just work in a linear way, they work with mutually as well. The Buddha himself gave the example of two sheaves of corn which are supporting each other. And if you take one away, the other falls over. But both are necessary to keep standing. It's not that one is causing the other. They are mutually supportive. So The other thing about conditionality, which Sagramati has an ongoing paper on conditionality, which I haven't yet properly looked at, but one of the things I've heard him say is that the difference with conditionality is that things are not predictable, not in the way that determinism talks about. And he gives the example of water. Water, as we know from our school chemistry, is a combination of two atoms of hydrogen to one of oxygen, H2O. And apparently, there is no way that you could predict that if you put hydrogen and oxygen together, you would get water. That is something you have to discover. It is not predictable. But it is definitely conditioned, on the basis of hydrogen and oxygen coming together, water arises. But it's not predictable in the way that determinism wants to claim the universe is. So that's one thing. However, one of the things that I sort of moved away from Sartre's everybody is free, is that I think we mustn't underestimate the power of conditionality. It's a little bit, I think, a bit glib just to talk about free will. Oh, we all have free will. It makes me wince sometimes when people say, well, yes, understandable, you know, he was brought up with a family of drug addicts, he never had any education, and he was beaten as a kid, and this, that, and the other. But he had free will. He didn't have to go out and beat up that old lady, you know? And it kind of seems to me a little bit glib, because conditions really do make such a difference. And thinking about this over the years, I've decided that, in a way, Schopenhauer's right. For the most part, we are completely conditioned. We are conditioned by, by our character, by our habits. We go around on automatic pilot, and while we're going around on automatic pilot, we have absolutely no freedom whatsoever. The only way we can ever have any freedom is if we're aware. And to me, it's awareness that is the magic ingredient. And this, I think, is what Buddhism can teach us. I don't know whether you've ever wondered quite why the Buddha put so much emphasis on mindfulness. Mindfulness is the key practice in Buddhism. Mindfulness, of course, with metta, because mindfulness by itself is not necessarily a good thing. Bank robbers can be mindful. Mindfulness has to go with metta. But metaphor mindfulness is what the Buddha emphasizes more than anything else. It was his last words, with mindfulness, strive on. He himself practiced mindfulness over and over again and encouraged everybody else to do the same thing. And I think that the key reason that he did that was that without mindfulness, we are not free at all. It requires awareness for us to be able to access. And I, you know, I could go into this and I could wax a bit fanciful about this is the way into Schopenhauer's noumenal. I do actually think the way Schopenhauer talks about the noumenal bears a lot of resemblance to the way the Buddha talks about the unconditioned. Because just in the same way that the Buddha says we can't really talk about the unconditioned, Schopenhauer says the same about the noumenal. He also says that the noumenal is not really different from the phenomenal. It's just a different way of understanding it. And that's exactly how the Buddha talks about the unconditioned. And if you read Sangharakshita, he seems to say that it's not that the unconditioned is something different. We reach the unconditioned when we fully understand and we fully penetrated the nature of the conditioned. And we can only do that by a deep practice of awareness, which is what we're doing every time that we meditate. And what awareness does, I must just say something about this, what awareness does, it allows for the possibility of the creative mind. The creative mind rather than the reactive mind. Any of you who have read, I think it's in a different format now, this is one of Sangharakshita's most brilliant booklets or teachings or whatever, Mind Reactive and Creative. And what he says is that for the most part, we are operating with reactive mind. Yeah? Just to give some examples of what he says here. He says the reactive mind does not really act, it only reacts. Instead of acting spontaneously out of its own inner fullness and abundance, it requires an external stimulus to set it in motion. So we are reacting to our environment all the time. We see a plate of biscuits and we go and eat one, and we never really think about whether we really want to or not. We are stimulated by our environment to do things. So he says the reactive mind is the conditioned mind. It's purely mechanical, he says. It's not free. Whatever we may think, inasmuch as we are acting according to the reactive mind, we are not free. It's repetitive, it's programmed by needs of which the mind is largely unconscious. It reacts to the same stimuli in much the same way. And like a machine, therefore, it goes on performing the same operation over and over again. I think this is what we are doing when we deny our freedom. This is what Sartre is talking about. When we're acting in bad faith, we become mechanical. We just do things because we are reacting. Human life as a whole becomes so much a matter of fixed and settled habit in a world of routine. And he says, above all, the reactive mind is the unaware mind. The unaware mind is asleep. He paints this lovely picture of most of us walking around as if we're asleep. Some people indeed are so fast asleep that for all their apparent activity, they can more adequately be described as dead. Their movements are those of a zombie or a robot with all its controls switched on, rather than those of a truly aware human being. And it's only when we become aware of our own unawareness, when we wake up to the fact that we're asleep, that spiritual life begins. So it is awareness that makes all the difference where we can actually access our own freedom. The creative mind, on the other hand, the creative mind does not react. It functions spontaneously out of the depths of its own intrinsic nature. What else does he say? Hang on. Yes, so not being dependent on any object, the creative mind is essentially non-conditioned. And at its highest pitch of intensity, the creative mind is identical with the unconditioned. So it's as if through spiritual practice, through awareness, it's as if our human birthright is to be free. But it's not something we can just say that we have. We haven't just got this free will. We only have it in potential. For most of the time, and I can sort of say this from my own experience, is that I know that for most of the time I'm just acting out of habit. We notice this, don't we? You know, I remember the time when it had a bin in a particular place in the kitchen. It was like that for years. Then we moved it, but I was still going over to where it was to put something in the bin. We do this all the time, don't we? Because we are not functioning as free human beings. We are functioning habitually. So that's what I want to leave you with, that thought, that Buddhism offers the possibility of creativity, of freedom. But it is only a possibility. It's not something we can take for granted. So that will do. I hope there may be a few minutes for questions if anybody wants to ask any.
Can I ask it? Do you see, talk about predictability, etc., do you see either within Western philosophy or within Buddhism anything to do with chance? Can things happen by chance?
Oh, that's interesting, isn't it? I didn't really... I guess that that's certainly some of the attempts to show that determinism is wrong have revolved around this idea that the complexity of causal connection is such that it allows for randomness. I don't know, I just remember seeing something about that it does allow for randomness and chance. And I guess there are philosophies which deny causality, aren't there? There are who say that actually everything is chance and just random. Interestingly enough, I think one of the things I find frustrating about, because I teach philosophy of religion, and one of the things I find quite frustrating is there's often this idea put across that either the universe is works, either there is a God in control, or it's just random chance. So the idea that there is inherent conditionality is not usually considered. Why do you ask that?
I'm not quite sure, but maybe it is from that sort of idea of, either God sort of preordaining everything, or I don't know. Maybe sometimes I think, well, has that happened by chance, or is there, you know, levels of conditionality? You know, it's just, it's so complex. You can never know why something happened. And but my sense of it is that there isn't randomness. There isn't that chance. It's just that, you know, I've got no way of really understanding why this has occurred.
Yes. Yes.
You know, there is actually causal factors. I'd say infinite causal factors.
So what appears to be chance is just that you don't know what those factors are. Quite possibly.
You brought up like the Calvinists and Christianity quite a bit, and I must say I don't agree with a lot of it, to be honest with you, because a lot of the theologists and the Calvinists believe that it was God that put Jesus on the cross, and it pleased Yahweh to crush him.
And so what so he was?
You know, like the Old Testament and the New Testament, everything leading up to that, it's even prophesied in the Old Testament what was going to happen to Jesus on the cross. And it wasn't the Romans, of course, it was played out historically like that. But that God actually, you know, they question his free will as well. Abraham on the mountain with the ram in the thicket, with his horns, that was the symbol of God. And they talk about a suffering God as well. So there's a lot of questions around free will with God himself. With the theologists, it's not this sort of exalted, everything sorted, pointing the finger of punishment, reward system. There's a whole personal evolution involved with man and God.
What you mean?
Quite a deep sort of interactive relationship, and they question, you know, God's free will himself.
God's own free will.
Yeah.
Oh, right.
And there's all that Abraham on the mountain. You know, pointing to Abraham to kill his child, and then he stops him. But they're thicker in the ram, which with his head, is that's God. You know, so they question God's own free will.
Right.
So I think it's really quite profound, that whole relationship.
I don't properly understand that, but you know.
Sorry, probably, I wasn't being very particular.
I don't quite. Yeah, I mean, there'd probably be quite a big discussion in itself, but that's interesting. Yes.
You said there at the beginning that determinism is predictable.
Determinism says that everything in principle is predictable. Yeah.
But, I mean, do they really? Because would they not see that it's only after the event that things are predictable? I mean, in hindsight, you can see patterns and so on, and you might say it's motives or character. In that sense, you could say it's predictable, but they're not prophesying, are they? They're not saying that they could actually see what is going to happen because of certain events.
Well, I think what they're saying is that you can't actually predict it because there are too many... there are too many factors to take into consideration, so you can't actually predict it. But that if you, that's why they say in principle you can predict it. So that if you, well, I think they probably would, I don't know really, but I presume they're saying that if you could actually account for all the things that are going to make something happen, then it would be completely predictable.
Couldn't be measured. So.
How do you mean?
Well, it's in principle, you can't measure
it. No. Well, that is the problem, isn't it? That is the trouble. It's a tricky one, isn't it? It's like the whole thing about omniscience, isn't it? And how, you know, if you knew someone, quite often you can predict what somebody's going to do, don't they? Can't you, when you know them really well? You say, I just know what they're going to do here. but that, you know, and the argument would say, well, if you knew them even better, you really would be able to predict what they're going to do. But, of course, well, personally, I believe that you can't. There's always got to be the possibility of them surprising you. There's always got to be the possibility that they won't do that. But it is an argument. Yeah. Sorry, say that again?
How does cause and effect exist in the world?
Well, this is the big question, isn't it, really? The big question is, does cause and effect operate in the same way when it's a sort of inner, when it's inner acts of will, inner choices? I suppose, yes, once you've made a choice, then that has an effect. But where that choice comes from, and I think, well, I suppose, it's a tricky one, isn't it? Because if we take the Buddha's conditionality, they arise, they don't arise out of the blue, they are conditioned. But that doesn't mean they are absolutely fixed. I think we all know from experience, the more awareness we bring to a situation, the less fixed it seems. And the more we have a sense of freedom, the more we have a sense of autonomy in our lives. Mindfulness really is quite magic. If you've ever had a really good meditation, just the hour afterwards, when you're really mindful, you feel much more like you're... Sorry, this isn't really answering your question, but you feel much more that you are a free agent living your life. But that doesn't mean it's there's no conditioning factors. I don't know whether I've answered your question there.
If a fact always has a force that can be predicted, how is everything working in free will?
Well, I suppose what I've been saying is that that's not necessarily the case, that everything can be predicted. Even things like, I remember that example of hydrogen and oxygen, you couldn't predict that that would produce water, apparently. Things are not so fixed and predictable. But that doesn't mean to say that cause and effect doesn't operate at all. In an everyday sense, there are causes leading to effects. Although every effect has, it has actually an infinite number of causes, really. I mean, if you look at it, if you really wanted to go into all the factors that brought you here tonight, well, you'd be here forever. You'd be forever trying to work them out. It might be a useful exercise. So there's never a kind of simple cause-effect.
I think it's really interesting on the Calvinists discussion, because as far as I know, Max Weber did a study on Calvinists and their views and how this... I think it was Max Weber, and I think it was to do with capitalist production of some kind, that the Calvinist view of the sort of determinist existence... he didn't say this, but in terms of what you've just said, in a sense, this determinist view could be undermined insofar as they would justify their good moral behaviour, because if you were shown to believe in any sense that you were damned, you therefore were damned, and that was the evidence of it. So you had to uphold within your actions the sense that you were elect by behaving in a moral way and being good to people and working hard and following all of these pursuits. So I think that's quite interesting if you then look at that from the Sartrean point of view that you were saying, in terms of having a sort of a free will element to it, like an angst, because surely to think that you must behave in a way that must not question your status as elect is going to surely have some underlying angst.
Yes, that's a good word, yes.
So I think that's quite an interesting way to look at
Calvinist. Yes, you'd have to, as a Calvinist, member of the Calvinist elect, you could never admit that you had freedom to do anything otherwise.
Even to yourself, I think is an interesting... Yeah. An interesting way to look at it. It's not something which I can actually imagine if I was in that situation myself.
No, I can't, but you could imagine that deep down there would be some angst.
Some angst there,
yeah. Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah.
As I understand it, Schopenhauer sees the nomen, as you were talking about Kant, he sees it as the will.
Yes.
Now,
but not the will, not the individual will. That's where there's a lot of misunderstanding.
Yeah. But Mr. Marshall, how would Buddha see the will? Because the will is a funny concept in itself.
Do you mean in terms of the individual will?
I mean, what is this?
Schopenhauerian will is a bit different. Schopenhauerian will really is the kind of force that makes anything happen, really. And that's a whole different aspect of his philosophy. So when you say, how does a Buddha see will, do you mean how does he see...
Well, how would he classify that element of the human being called the will?
Well, as I said, he actually... put that, if you can say it's will, he put it as one of the five skandhas. He said it was conditioned.
But what is this thing that's being conditioned? That's
right, okay, so, well, yeah, what is it indeed? Well, we could say, I mean, what, in terms of our experience, it is what prompts us to act. I don't think I can say more than that, really.
But the point is, isn't it a problem as to what it is that prompts us to act in the first place? I mean,
yes, yes, indeed, yes. That's right. What indeed does prompt us to act, yeah. And, yeah.
So before you say it's free or conditioned, we have to see what it is that is doing this.
Yeah.
I just wonder if Buddha's had a certain take on that. Because there is, in any way...
I thought it was suffering. Go ahead. I thought that was the point of the reactive mind, so trying to escape from something that's... There's a set of conditions that's created something that's painful, and that's what causes you to then act in a particular way. And if you bring awareness, then you can... And you've got awareness that it will pass over, that it won't last, then you don't have to act on it. You then are making a choice to...
Right, yes.
I mean, they know that.
Yes.
Something along those lines.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, that's certainly true, isn't it, that we are motivated by craving. We're motivated, trying to escape suffering. But what actually motivates us most of the time...
Well, some people may not try and escape suffering, or choose to have awareness or whatever. Because if Shivananda sees it as the will, and he sort of links it that therefore it's not... You know, a real mystery, we can know it because it's something we all know, this power in us. Then in a way that gap between the known and phenomena is bridged.
Sorry, that gap?
That gap, the known and the phenomena gap is bridged in a way. It's not that separate, is it, in Schopenhauer?
Well, in Schopenhauer it's not separate at all, no.
Because it's will, it's bridged.
I
just wonder, you know, your take on that.
I'm not sure I have a take on that, actually. I don't think I quite understand what you're asking. And I do wonder whether we ought to... It's 5 to 10. Do you think we ought to bring it to... I think we probably ought to bring it to a close. But maybe I need to talk to you about that another time.
Okay.
Yeah. One more
question. Yeah, I wondered how you distinguish decision and choice. Because it appeared to me that you're using it interchangeably, and I thought there was a distinction.
How would you see the distinction?
I always felt that a decision is a selection based on reason. In terms of coming here, I say it's good for me, it does this and that. And choice is more a selection after consideration.
That sounds like the same thing to me. Consideration and reason.
No, for you make it. Let's say you have the selection of a husband. This is a very personal effect. So, or husband or wife, and you could now go through all the reasons you have for her or him. You know, he's good looking and he's doing that. And
oh right, yeah. Yes, yes.
So then, 5 years down the line, all these reasons are no longer valid, therefore your selection is no longer valid.
Okay.
So, well, when you choose, you have a number of considerations, you spend some time with him, and then you take all these reasons aside and you just go for it and you stick with it.
Oh, I see. So choice can be irrational, you're saying, in a way.
It can be unreasonable.
I think decisions can be as well, can't they?
Yeah, decisions are always based on... That's the way I see it. They are always based on reason. So when then the reasons change, the selection becomes invalid, and then you martyr yourself why you make that decision.
Well, yeah? Possibly. Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
So I think that in the context of what you said earlier with Sartre and the other guy, Schopenhauer, maybe. No. Determinist view.
Oh, Schopenhauer, yeah.
Yeah, Schopenhauer, then... I think Schopenhauer is in the decider field, and maybe Sartre more in the choosing.
I don't quite understand what the distinction is, actually. I was, as you say, using them interchangeably. And I can see that some choices or decisions are made through reason, and some aren't. But I wouldn't necessarily say that one is definitely one and one is the other, but possibly you could make a case for that.
I thought choice is something which has more freedom to it than
right.
decisions.
Okay.
Decisions are always bounds to reasons.
Yeah, it sounds like it a little bit, doesn't it? Yeah, decision sounds very final.
Yeah, you're cutting other things
yeah,
off.
Yeah, possibly.
Anyway.
Maybe just, yeah, the way we're using words. So, yeah, yeah, fair enough. It's good to sort of... It's good to be clear about what we mean when we say things, that's true. Well, I think that's just about it, actually, folks. Thank you very much for your patience. It's been a long talk for longer than a minute.